Welcome to the Continued Silence with me, Emma Jane Taylor, here on UK Radio. The Continued Silence is focused on the very uncomfortable conversations of child sexual abuse and the importance of talking openly about this subject. We want to try and normalise a very difficult conversation. Child sexual abuse is real. It affects millions of people, young and old, across the world. The work we do here is very much engaging more thought processes on this terrible crime. We want to support survivors, protect children, and encourage those who aren't listening to listen. Joining me each show is my resident panel. Usually, therapist Denny Corby would be here, but she isn't with us for this show. Today, it's going to be very much about mandatory reporting. And who best to join us for this conversation than Chris Tuck, someone who has done an extremely extreme amounts of work towards this conversation, and someone who I know will take it on in a very positive way, hopefully. Maybe not, we'll find out. And Pam Betancourt is here. She's from Boston. She is a survivor of child sexual abuse. She was abused from 13 to 23 by someone known to the family. She is a registered nurse, and she will be discussing mandatory reporting in America. How will it differ? Well, we are about to find out. Chris, great to have you with us. Before we sort of get into the nuts and bolts of things, obviously this is a big conversation for you, isn't it?
It is because I truly believe that if mandatory reporting was in place when I was a child, when I disclosed to three different statutory services, my school, the police, social services, I believe that if mandatory reporting was in place, that I would have been saved from further harm and abuse as a young person. And the earlier the intervention I should have received would have meant that any impact resulting from that abuse that I suffered from, I may have not had such an impact on my entire life if I had been saved, if those people that knew about the abuse of me, because I told them, if they'd stepped in and done their job. So that is why I'm an advocate for mandatory reporting.
Thank you, Chris. Great to have you with us. Ham, thank you for joining us today. We haven't worked with you before on this show, but it's great to have you with us. And you're in Boston, I know that. You obviously have gone through trauma yourself, and you are now a nurse. So, before we sort of go into more depths of this conversation, what do you know around the work that you're doing that you feel would sort of like facilitates this conversation in America?
Well, thank you, Emma Jane, for having me here. I am in the medical field, and even with these people that are mandatory reporters and also should be very well versed in, recognizing the different signs, I see the ignorance. All the time. I mean, the doctors, other nurses, I see it just getting overlooked and people not asking the right questions, people not, behaving, how a victim needs a person to be supportive, someone that you may suspect as being in a relationship that, is unhealthy for them. They need to be supported. They need to feel comfortable. They need to, feel like they're being heard. And so, even though I'm around mandatory reporters all the time, I don't see the people that are the mandatory reporter having the information to make that decision.
Okay, this is really interesting. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Pam. So mandatory, I mean, let's go back to the ICER reports, Chris. You've done a great deal of work. So let's go to you, Chris. So you've done a lot of work on this conversation from the beginning, the ICER, the report, the whole journey. So let's just go a little bit more into that before we go into mandatory reporting. Why did you think this was all really, really important?
So the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse was set up in 2015 to look at or investigate child sexual abuse within institutions. So sexual abuse that was taken place inside institutions, so care homes, for example, religious settings, for example, and the abuse was being covered up, it wasn't being dealt with. So it was looking specifically at child sexual abuse within institutions, but it was also looking at those who had been sexually abused and were let down by the statutory services that should have been there to protect them. So it was twofold, really. And it looked at victim and survivors' experiences through the public hearings into specific institutions. It looked at or heard from over 7,000 victim and survivors who had been abused within institutions and or had been let down by institutions through the Truth Project. And it also undertook many research projects. And it married all of that information together to produce the final report, which was published in November 2022. And it made 20 final recommendations that we needed the government to take on as a package of measures to implement them so that we can better protect children and young people from child sexual abuse today and going forwards. So that's the context of it all. And we are still fighting, literally fighting, 1 year on for the government to see the importance of the publication and to hold them to account, really, to actually implement these recommendations.
So basically, 7,000 victims weren't listened to.
Victim survivors, they were listened to through the inquiry. It's the government's response now, whether those voices are truly heard or not, and that is what we are fighting for.
Yes, and that's what I meant. So the victims, so the government are not taking this seriously. We're a year on, and you're still fighting this. I see it around all the time. I realize obviously the seriousness and the importance of it. And I guess the question is, why aren't the government taking it seriously? Why, what is your thoughts as to why they aren't moving this forward, Chris?
So they've taken the 20 recommendations, and then their response to the 20 recommendations, they've put in their reason as to what they're doing as a justification as to they've implemented a particular recommendation. But where we're sitting, they haven't done that. So they are saying, like most politicians will say, they're doing X, Y, and Z, or have done A, B, and C. And you're like, not from where I'm sitting. So it's going to cost an awful lot of money. And I mean, so much more than what the inquiry cost to implement all of these recommendations. But isn't keeping children safe worth every penny that we spend? It is, in my view, and I think we need
100%.
to hold the government to that view as well. Why are they not implementing it? I don't know. I keep knocking at their door. I keep asking that question, and all we keep being told is we're working on it, we're working through it. And as we can see, the way of the world at the moment, there are so many other issues going on that this gets a backseat yet again. And so we've got to keep pulling it up their agenda and make sure that we keep a spotlight on it, because most inquiries, their reports will end up on a shelf. This inquiry, their report is not, because it's too important. It affects so many children and young people, as well as the adults that are going through it, have gone through it, and also are going on to have families. It just needs to stop. Someone needs to be held accountable. We need a different response to child sexual abuse. And them saying, oh, we can do this, that, and the other, and it will all work, is nonsense. All they're doing is patching up a system that is broken.
So, Chris, I couldn't agree more. I mean, There'd be there's no money that would restrict anyone, should restrict anyone from protecting children, from supporting this conversation. So there are big red question marks around why they aren't pursuing these conversations. And yeah, of course, there's always going to be other conversations, important conversations going on. The world at the moment feels absolutely full and expanding of difficulties and sadness and issues, global issues, children being hurt, people being innocently killed. And of course, that they're serious as well, but so is this. This is a really, really serious conversation. It needs to be better responded, it needs to be acted on. And so it does make you question why this mandatory reporting isn't just implemented. I mean, I know it's not just as easy as that, but surely just to get that process a year on, think how far forward they could be a year on. So you do then have to question, like you say, what is the agendas if you cannot, after, all, how many years was the ICSA in process for before you got to this result?
2015 to 2022. So, do you want me to bring
Eight
you up
years.
to date where the
7 years.
MRR?
Yes, so give 7 years to get to this point, 7,000 voices, and where are we?
So, they, after the publication of the report, they took it away, read it, and came back with their responses. So, their response to recommendation number 13 was, we accept the need for mandatory reporting. The government has agreed to implement a mandatory reporting regime for child sexual abuse, which will be informed by a full public consultation, beginning with the publication of a call for evidence. So that call for evidence happened. Anybody could respond to it. So it's organisations, statutory services, third sector, and individuals. And I personally did respond to it. And I know many victim and survivors did, to say what the model should look like. So they asked loads and loads of questions. In my opinion, they didn't ask the right questions, but they asked loads of questions. That went back to them. All of that rich information went back to them on the 14th of August. They were meant to publish a response. So, government were meant to publish a response to the consultation. We haven't seen that. But what they have done is sent out a further consultation because they wanted to test opinions on a small number of undecided policy questions. And the consultation on that closes by the end of November. So once they have all of that, we will wait to see what they're coming up with as a model and whether it's actually workable. But to be fair to them, they have consulted so many different people and organizations. And just by working with ICSA changemakers, for example, and Act on ICSA, just working with different groups of people, it's very difficult to come up with a model when you've got so many different views, opinions, and experiences, what will work and what won't work. So it is a big piece of work, but that should not stop us from doing it because it will better protect children from CSA if implemented correctly.
It seems complex, doesn't it? It shouldn't be this hard. It shouldn't be this hard. It shouldn't be this long, and it shouldn't cost so much money. And actually, quite frankly, if it costs three times more than that to get this into place, then great, get it in. You can find the money. Governments seem to find their money for everything else. Why can't they find the money for this? And so that would be one of my questions. Okay, Pam, great to have you with us. Sometimes I hear things like that, and you sort of feel, God, it's so embarrassing in the UK on this conversation that we, that you know, what Chris has just said, 7 years, 7,000 victim survivors. I don't know how much money. Do you know how much money went on the whole thing, Chris?
186 million
Oh my word.
180.
was spent on the inquiry. But you know what? I know people can't see this because we are on radio, but this is the report, and every single page contains the voice of victim and survivors. So no one can dispute this report. No one can dispute its contents. So we just got to keep pushing the agenda forwards.
And because of people like Chris, I know that it will be pushed forward. But you know, like I say, Pam, you know, I sit here sometimes. I think the government is embarrassing at times, that they just cannot see the seriousness of this conversation. Yeah, of course they're working hard on other things, aren't we all? But actually, if people really turn their head to the importance of this, protecting children, getting the mandatory reporting in, how better off would we be here in the UK? Well, I think a lot better off, actually, as does Chris and everybody involved in the research of this great big book Chris has just hold up. If you haven't seen it, then have a look. Can you buy that, Chris?
You can download it.
You can download it. Where do you download it from?
www.iicsa.org.uk.
And I know when you look on there, there'll be the full version. There is a more lighter version if anyone wants to read that as well. So thank you, Chris. Pam, you're going to obviously update us with what's going on in America, and we'll open out those discussions between what you're doing out there and what we're doing here, because I think it's really a great conversation today to have. So, welcome to today's show, Pam. Thank
Thank
you
you.
for giving up your time to talk to us. And I know you're a busy you're a busy registered nurse as well. So, appreciate your time.
Thank you, Emma Jane. In the United States, they do have a lot of mandatory reporting laws, and there are a lot of different people that are considered mandatory reporters, and they do try to enforce that. Over here, I think it's more of educating people so that they know what they're seeing. They did add, like, so I'm a registered nurse, and every 2 years we have to have a certain amount of continuing education hours to keep our license active. And they did add on a few years ago, not only sexual abuse, domestic violence, and abuse, they added on a certain amount of hours that we had to take in that field out of our continuing education credits. So they are trying to educate, but a lot more education needs to go on over here. I had one of the first people that I ever told about my abuse was a friend of mine. He was a doctor. And you think of doctors and you think that they're educated in, such a wide range of different topics. But he said to me, when I told him, he told me, he said, "You really are above my pay grade." He said, "Your situation, needs to have somebody who specializes in that." Now, he was probably joking a little bit, but not a lot. He said, "We only get 2 weeks of psychology in medical school to become a doctor." And that's it. I mean, that's it right there. They're not being taught the signs, the symptoms, how to properly treat victims. It requires a specialty. And even at that, when I was going through my abuse, my abuser, his wife was a nurse as well. And she was a psychiatric nurse. So she should have seen every sign. It was just so obvious to me today, looking back, it was so obvious what was happening to me in her home. And she did step up, and she had noticed that my personality was changing, my I appeared depressed to her. So she sent me to my primary care. And I promised her I'd go because I was afraid not to, because I didn't want her to, because I was terrified. I didn't want her to know. I didn't want anyone to know. I did my best to keep it from everybody. But in his home, it was very obvious what was happening to me. Not my he was never at my parents' house. I was always all the abuse happened in his house, or outside of his house, but with him. And I went to my primary care and I told my primary care that I was feeling depressed. I felt like, my life just wasn't what I wanted it to be. And I just kind of downplayed it with him. And he told me that I need, and I told him that, what I thought it was hormonal. I thought it was, happening more and more every month. So he told me he wanted me to see a gynecologist. So he walked me from his office down the hall to a gynecologist. And the gynecologist came into me and he got down on his chair, the little four-wheel stool, and I was sitting over in the corner and he wheeled right up in my face and he said to me, "You need to tell me what's going on. There's more going on than what you're sharing with us." And I froze. I panicked. I froze. I was terrified. I kept denying it. And he's like, "You're not telling me the truth. I want you to see a psychiatrist." And there was a psychiatrist down the hall from him. So he said, "Don't leave my office until I come back." He said, "If you leave, I'm going to have the police go to your house and pick you up." And so the minute he left his office, of course, I was terrified. So I ran out of there, got in my car, and drove home. And I was afraid he was going to send the police to my house. So I called my abuser's wife and asked her, I said, "Is that possible? Can he send the police here? I ran out of his office. He told me not to leave." And she said, "Yes, they can do that. And you need to call your primary care, let your primary care doctor know that you're safe and that you're home, and see if he can stop the psychiatrist or the gynecologist from sending the police to your house." So that's what I did. So she was helping me cover up the situation I just went through with all these mandatory reporters, and they knew something was going on. And the person I went to was the person I trusted, and I trusted her. I shouldn't have trusted her because she was a mandatory reporter as well, who could have just reported it. But I didn't want her to, go that route. So I called my primary care, and my primary care said, "Okay, I'll let them know that you're okay, you're safe." And he did. And that was the end of it. So all those people that were mandatory reporters didn't report anything that they suspected. So there is mandatory reporting over here, but I think a lot of people are afraid to report wrong information instead of going with their gut and just, believing in what they're seeing and not trying to justify what they're seeing. It doesn't get reported. So, in the United States, they do try to, make the mandatory reporters do the reporting, but I think without the education, we're not going to get the people to do the reporting, which is sad.
Well, thank you, Pam, for sharing all of that. Heartbreaking, actually, to hear that so many people could have mandatory reported. It is in place in America that you do mandatory report, but no one did. How long has mandatory reporting been in America? Do you know?
I'm not sure how long. I know it's been around a long time because even there was another situation where I was probably about 16. I'm 60 now. I was probably about 16, and my abuser took me out in his car, and we were parked along a riverbank, And it was a Sunday evening, and there were very there were he excuse me, he always went where there was no cars around. So we were parked along a riverbank, along a main road, and a police officer pulled up, and it was the windows were steamy. It was a cool night. And so the police officer couldn't really see inside the car, so he knocked on the window, on the driver's side window, and we panicked because here somebody is catching, in the act, catching the abuser abusing me. So my abuser opened the window a little bit, and so it was a police officer, and the police officer said, step out of your car. So my abuser rolled the window back up, and he said to me before he got out of the car, he said, "Whatever you say, you're 16 years old." So I was not 16; I was probably about 14. He says, "Whatever you say, you're 16 years old." So he gets out of the car, and they're out there talking. I have no idea what they're saying. I was so scared. I thought, my parents were going to find out that the police officer was going to take me, and my abuser gets back in the car, and he says he wants to talk to you. You're 16 years old. So he comes over to the passenger side. He opens the door. I get out, and he has a flashlight, and he's flashing it right in my face. And he says to me, "How old are you?" I said, 16. He said, "Okay, get back in the car and get out of here." I did not look 16. Even if I was 16, there was no questions. I don't know what my abuser said to him. I don't know what the story was. He didn't ask me. He didn't try to corroborate any of the information that he was given. He basically told me to get, I mean, it was a situation where I was terrified, but I was also kind of happy, hoping that maybe this was the end of my abuse and it was now out of my hands and something was going to happen. But he basically put me right back into the situation. So, I mean, a police officer, you would think, would be somebody who would investigate a little bit of the situation, but he didn't. And mandatory reporting, I think, at least with police officers and, medical personnel back then, was definitely in place.
So, having just had a little bit more of a look around, it was around mid 1960s when it was introduced, and it says mandatory reporters are required to report the facts and circumstances that led them to suspect a child had been abused or neglected. They do not have the burden of providing proof that the abuse or neglect has occurred. Permissive reporters follow the same standards when electing to make a report. So there was no good reason for anyone not to report, right? If they had suspected, and I'd like to know what happens if you suspect and you don't report. I'd like to look into that a little bit more. But Chris has got a hand up, so I'll leave you with Chris.
Yeah, I was just going to pick up on a few things. But for us under this recommendation 13, it says the government notes that those who work with children or hold positions of trust are in a unique position to help prevent abuse and identify when a child is suffering abuse. The government goes on to say that even though it has set clear statutory and non-statutory guidance that practitioners working with children should immediately make a referral to local authority children's social care if they believe a child has or is likely to suffer harm. Despite these existing safeguards, they know that the abuse of children still goes unreported. So that backs up really what Pam was saying, is that even though we have safeguards in place already, and if you ask people like teachers, so when I ask my friends who are teachers what safeguarding and what reporting goes on, and they went, well, any kind of suspicion, any known abuse, we will report. Why wouldn't you? And that's the argument. If you know or suspect, why wouldn't you report? And most people, professionals, will do if they've had the right training, if they work within a practice that where the culture is correct, i.e. it's there to protect children, the policies and procedures are worth the paper that they're written on, because everybody is working towards the same thing, and everyone knows exactly what they should be doing, when they should be doing it, and in what circumstances. So there seems to be a difference as well, in that adult survivors, especially those victim and survivors that attended the Truth Project, they said that if a mandatory reporting duty was in place when they were children, they would have been better protected, received earlier interventions, and not suffered in silence for decades. But only if those mandated reporters had the training and were able to respond appropriately. So it's really interesting that some organisations that work with children and young people now, they are saying that if mandatory reporting was in place as a law, they would not, the children and young people would not report, because they wouldn't want the criminal justice to take over. They want the abuse to stop, they want help and support, and they don't necessarily want to go down the criminal justice route. However, we have as adults a duty of care to children and young people, and if we know about abuse or we suspect it, we should be reporting it, because that's our duty of care. So there's a difference of opinion as to if you're a child and young person, or if you are an adult, as to what should happen. And this is also being explored right at this moment through this mandatory reporting consultation that is currently taking place. And why I put that post up this morning asking, why have we got a difference of opinion here, and what should happen so that we don't disempower young people that come forward who do disclose but don't really want it to be acted upon the way that us adults expect it to be acted upon. So there's a lot of complexity around this. Open for conversation and more debate, hence why it is taking so long to come up with a workable model that suits professionals, children and young people, and everybody involved, to be honest.
Thank you, Chris. Well, look, we're going to take a short break now. Don't go anywhere. We will be back after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so a lot of discord around this conversation then, from all sorts of people. And if I go back to you, Pam, with what you were saying, mandatory reporting in America, it imposes penalty, often in the fine of an imprisonment or a fine or imprisonment, for anyone who's failing to report suspected child abuse or neglect as required by law. So I guess there's a bigger question, Chris, is that if you haven't had any training and you suspect that something doesn't feel right about the child, what fear would hold you back from reporting or getting further involved in something that could end up being quite a complex situation? I know I would report. I know that you'd report, and Pam and every survivor I know would report that. But anyone who's not attached to this conversation, I feel, I might be wrong, might have some real concerns about reporting a child. So is it something that is done anonymously? and how does the process undo? Do you know that?
The actual reporting of any
Yeah, so
suspected.
if someone's going to report that they suspect a child has been sexually abused, can they do that anonymously, or will they have to become part of that process?
So mandated reporters within organisations, there will be a process and procedure that will need to follow. And many organisations have their own safeguarding policy that they train their staff up on, and that is what people should follow. However, we know from victim survivors that took part in the inquiry that those processes and policies, if even if they were followed to protect the reputation of the organisation, the allegations didn't go any further. And that is the whole reason why this mandatory reporting has come about, because we now really want sanctions for those that do or are complicit in actual cover-ups of reported or known abuse cases. Yeah, because we don't want this not to go on anymore, because it's been going on for too long, where there are cover-ups of known abuse cases and where people are complicit in that, then there should be sanctions like fines, like custodial sentences, in my opinion, to send out a clear message that institutions, organisations cannot put their reputation before the protection of children. We're just not having it. You'll find that most decent human beings will want to report and will want to protect children. But for some reason, over the decades and even now, there are still these cover-ups going on. And we need to, as I said, send out a clear message that this is not to be tolerated anymore. So part of the consultation for the mandatory reporting is, who should the duty apply to? What should be reported? What sanctions should be given to mandatory reporters or mandated reporters if they don't report? So there's all these different questions that they want answers to. And sometimes the answers to the questions, well, it all depends. But for me, it's like quite clear cut. No, the child needs protecting, report. So even if there's not enough evidence in a case, yeah, the fact that you've reported A, someone else, I don't know, a year later reports B, and then a couple of months later, someone else reports C. We're picking up a picture, aren't we? We're building up a picture. And then eventually there will be enough evidence to move on something. So all of this, oh yeah, I heard about a rumor. Oh yeah, it was well known back then. Everybody knew. It's just not good enough, you know? Rumors, and we all knew, that's not evidence. But if you all knew something, then where is the professional curiosity to actually go, actually, I've heard a rumor, or I've seen something and I'm not quite sure. I'm going to note it, I'm going to report it, and I'm going to keep my eyes open, my ears peeled, and I will take further action if needed. Yeah. So it's not always about having a solid evidential base for something, but it's about building up a picture if you're unsure.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
So if anyone's in an organisation who believes something might have happened, there'll be a team above that you can go to who will process the mandatory reporting and take it from you and further forward. So obviously we know that it's a good thing to do. We want it to be implemented. It needs to happen here in the UK. It is happening in America. What are you seeing, Pam, in America, having heard all this that's going on in the UK? I mean, you must sort of roll your eyes, really, because it must seem absolutely ludicrous that we're even having this conversation. But what do you sort of feel as someone, as a survivor, as a professional who knows this conversation from the American point of view, and what you've just heard Chris say about what's happening here in the UK, what could you say or add now that would, you know, add value to what Chris and everyone is trying to do in the UK to get this mandatory reporting alive?
I think it's ludicrous that there isn't mandatory reporting over there. That is the first step. Child sexual abuse, the signs are very detectable. If you know what you're looking at, then there is no justifying the behavior. So many people that were around me when my abuse was going on, even just lay people, not mandatory reporters, you know, a sister-in-law, a neighbor, the daughter of my abuser, all went to his wife with concerns about the relationship that him and I had. And every single time she went to him with the concern, she never once asked me, never once asked me anything. So, I mean, people will recognize, you know, it will, you know, they'll raise an eyebrow, they'll see, you know, certain behaviors. And a mandatory reporter, it should be, you know, clear cut what's going on. And there should be no question whether they should report it or not. Yes, absolutely. You know, in some cases, maybe they're wrong. No harm done. You know, you're possibly saving a child that is being abused. And that should be your focus. You know, the society needs to step up. Kids that are being abused can't help themselves. They've already been groomed. They, you know, from a family member, you know, the one incident out on the street, you know, could be a totally different situation. But when it's ongoing by somebody that the child loves and cares about and, you know, is intertwined into the family relationships, that kid is not going to help themselves. They're not going to be able to, in most cases, stand up for themselves. They need society to be able to get them out of that situation. The groomers, the abusers, they're very smart people. They're manipulative. They're usually very well liked. They look like every other person in the family. There's no physical signs of an abuser. They're going to act as normal as possible because they need to be, in order to be successful, they need to fit into society. And people need to be, you know, aware of that and look at the behaviors. And, you know, if you're wrong once, then so be it. You know, the person that they're accusing, you know, may feel like their reputation is being ruined, or that can be rebuilt. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. There's no harm done. But if the reporter is right, then they've just saved a kid from living. I lived 10 years with my abuser because nobody would go with their gut and nobody would stand up for me. And I did not at all expect anyone in my family to recognize it, because like I said, all the abuse happened at his house, and I would not tell anybody in my family. I mean, I'm the youngest of six. I have a twin sister, and you know, it's a very close Catholic family. I just always hoped that my future would be better than my present. I didn't go to anybody in my family. My father was a very honest person, and I honestly believed that he probably would have killed my abuser. And then my family would have been left with my father in jail because of me. So kids get put into such a horrible situation. They don't know what's right to do. They don't know how to do anything. So society really needs to step up and be able to, you know, stand up for the kids. So to think that the UK doesn't have any mandated reporting laws is just ludicrous to me. It gives, you know, abusers, you know, the right to continue doing what they're doing. It's bad.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree with you. It's ludicrous. It makes you question agendas. It makes you question conversation. It makes you question what an hell is going on back there that this isn't in place. America's mid-60s mandatory reporting. I mean, 50 years later, I mean, ridiculous. I mean, beyond ridiculous that Chris and, you know, everybody that I know she works with on these conversations are still fighting, and won't stop, I know, but it shouldn't be this hard. It, you know, like you say, Pam, even if you're wrong, it's better to have an investigation, and in a way that is just on high level, just to assess the situation, just to make sure a child is protected. Common sense, right? The children are the generations to follow. They are our future. Why wouldn't you want to look after them? Why wouldn't you want to safeguard them? Why wouldn't you want to have things in place to report whoever you are? Well, like you say, whether you're a layperson, whether you're a mandatory reporter, whether you're in the institution, whoever you are, wherever you are, it would seem like the most sensible, normal thing to report. Chris.
So I agree, Pam, with what you're saying, that we as a society need to step up and protect children and young people. But I just want to reiterate something that I said earlier that I was quite astounded by, but I'm getting my head around it. Some of the organisations, support service organisations, that are working with children and young people, but it's the young people that I want to speak about now. They're saying, the young people are saying, when they're asked about mandatory reporting, that if they disclose to someone, an adult, and then that adult had to report the abuse, because that's what mandatory reporting is all about, they would then not disclose. This is what I'm being told. So there's a disconnect between when you are a young person and being asked this, as a young person, and then years later when you're an adult and you realize, actually, I can't make those kind of decisions. Exactly how Pam, you described it, it needs to be taken out of our hands, because we can't really, my personal opinion, make those judgments as a young person. But we're being told, in, as part of this conversation, that we're disempowering young people if we're not listening to what it is they want. So there is this juxtaposition going on. For me, mandatory reporting was about taking appropriate action where there is a clear disclosure and a will to take action on behalf of children and young people. Failure to acknowledge and validate, failure to take immediate and appropriate action, in my opinion, is a dereliction of duty. It's to have both professional and criminal sanctions. Because, Pam, I, like you, I actually told the police, social care, and my school. They took it to a certain place, but then the response they gave me left me subject to more abuse and more harm, because they didn't respond in the right way. One, they didn't believe me and verbally told me that. So that shut me down and silenced me for many, many years. And it added a layer of impact to that recovery. But we just need to somehow make sure that we empower young people in particular. Because when it comes to young children, you're just going to do the mandatory reporting no matter what, because that you can't take into account what that child is telling you, because they just don't know. But when a child is older, so they're a young teenager or an older teenager, if they come to you and disclose and you then go, okay, well, I've just got a report because you've just told me something, that young person is no longer going to trust you and not share anything with you. And professional services are finding that if they have to disclose or report on a teenager's, for example, disclosure, that trust is then broken. And those teenagers that have disclosed, they will withdraw their disclosure. And that puts them in a situation where they are not getting the appropriate support. So it really is, there's a lot to think about. So something that we think there's a black and white answer to it, there's a lot of nuances and there's a lot of grey areas. There's a lot of things to consider. And also the professionals are worried about a broken system that we've got already, where there is already so many children and young people that are not being responded to in the right way. Workloads are up here, okay? And they're saying that reporting's going to happen for reporting's sake. And part of this mandatory reporting call for evidence, the people that are working on it from organisations are saying that reporting shouldn't just have a criminal justice outcome. There needs to be the appropriate help and support built in, not only for the victim, but for the family. And that all costs a lot of money. So if you're going to put a mandatory reporting model in, it needs to be the right model. It needs to address so many different issues and challenges and nuances. And it needs to work on the grassroots level in order to better protect children and not to make it go the other way, where young people will just retract their disclosure because now they've got people acting on their behalf when they didn't want them acting on their behalf and the trust is broken. So there's a lot that goes into this. It's not just black and white like I want it to be and maybe like you want it to be.
Thank you, Chris. Well, look, we're coming up to the end of the show, and I think it's been a really informative show. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Pam, for sharing all the things that you've shared today with us. Pam, you also have a book, and it's called But I Am Here, and it's available on Amazon. So if anyone's listening, go and search that out on Amazon. Pam's main key message is that nobody should have to live with what I lived through. Child sexual abuse in most cases is detectable. There is a process that takes place before physical abuse happens. Children typically will not be able to understand what is happening. Adults need to be aware of their signs. So thank you, Pam. Thank you, Chris. If you would like any information on any of Chris's work, you find her on Chris at ChrisTuck_WWHF on Twitter. She is there doing a great deal of work on this conversation, especially mandatory reporting. So do go and check her out. And if you want to read Pam's book, go onto Amazon. And it is called But I Am Here. And you'll find out a lot more about Pam and the work that she's done. From me, thank you very much for listening. It's been a great show. It's gone very, very quickly. And again, I think we need 4 hours. But thank you to everyone behind the scenes, to Johan, to Christine, everyone at UK Health Radio. I'll see you next time. Thank you.